Mindset. An Open-Ended Avengers Verse by Sidney Sussex. Read by Reganim. Anchor and Hold. Part 1 of the Mindset series. Please note that this fic has trigger warnings for discussion of mental health issues. Check your watch. 2 o'clock in the morning, almost to the second. He checked again. 2 o'clock. Check the slim, silver digital clock mounted over the door of the shooting range. 2 o'clock. Probably time he put away the bow and got some sleep. You sure? Checked the clock again. 2:01. His watch agreed, and he paused for a moment, eyes flicking between the two, watching the seconds count off. Perfectly in sync. The watch had been a gift from Phil. Well, from Tony. But Phil was the one who had asked Tony to put it together, citing something about needing Clint's timekeeping to match up with everyone else's, even when he was stationed far from the rest of the team. It had been a good line, and Tony had nodded. And now Clint had a watch with a tiny maser in it, spontaneously oscillating to keep time, a miniature atomic clock for his wrist. His time was never wrong. When they went into the field, everybody else synchronized their chronographs with his watch. Hell, Jarvis was synchronized with his watch. Clint couldn't explain why it mattered, but it did. Okay, 2:04 in the morning. He'd been locked in here practicing for the better part of 6 hours now, and it was working, like it always did. Steady rhythms of knock, draw, release, letting his mind blank itself out, letting him forget for a little while. If he didn't think about anything, he didn't have to worry about anything. If he didn't think about anything, he could let go. Slowly, he disassembled the bow, coiling the string around 4 fingers of his right hand and tucking it into its sleeve. The smooth curves of the bow arms felt good in his hands. He tested them gently, once, twice, then put them away as well, fitting the riser into its slot between them, settling it securely. Normally, he practiced with the compound bow, because it was what he took into the field most often. But his first love had been recurve, and on rough days, it was what he went back to when he needed to tune out for a while. Today had been a recurve day. He closed the lid of the bow case, paused, opened it again, checked that everything was in place. 1 finger ran gently along the servings of the bowstring. A little bit of wax collected there, he noticed, and the serving at the knocking point was getting kind of worn anyway. Damn it. He knew better than to look so closely at something like that, this late at night. Okay. All right. He should be in bed, he knew that, but it wasn't going to work, just telling himself that. There was wear on the serving. He needed to fix that. Wouldn't be able to sleep if he didn't. So instead of dwelling on the time, later and later, as his watch quietly hummed past 2:30, he fumbled in a drawer in the armory until his fingers closed around a reel of purple 62XS. There. Okay. And the jig was already set up, and the serving tool was at his shoulder, firmly gripped in Phil's hand. He looked up. Silence, for a moment, and then he gestured to the bowstring he was holding, already looped around one end of the jig. Little bit of wear on the knocking point. Thought I'd take care of it before. It's 2:39 in the morning. Automatically, Clint checked his watch, the clock, his watch, the clock. Only take a minute. Phil looked at him as though he wanted to say something, but in the end he just surrendered the serving tool and took a seat next to the bowstring jig, careful to sit so that he was in line with Clint's peripheral vision while he worked. Having people hovering behind him, where he couldn't see, made Clint uncomfortable. Phil knew that. Clint checked his watch again. Phil knew a lot of things. It was true, though, about the serving. The whole job really did take less than 5 minutes, and then the string was back in its sleeve. The bow case closed. Checked. Phil held it open, letting him look, but not handing over the case. Closed again, and put away. Done? Phil asked him. Clint stepped through the doors into the range again, flipped on the harsh lights, and did a last visual scan before locking the door, closing it, and testing the handle. Done. Phil trailed him all the way to his quarters, 10 steps behind and off to the side where Clint could see him, waiting until Clint tipped his head inquiringly, inviting Phil inside. They were long past the point where either of them needed that kind of invitation, but sometimes, when Phil found Clint in the armory in the middle of the night with his recurve bow, he waited for Clint's lead anyway. Sitting on the edge of the bed, stripping down to boxer shorts and crew neck. He listened to the sounds from the bathroom. Phil knew the routine well by now. Wash hands, brush teeth, wash hands again. Clint did things twice. That was just how he worked. Of course, there were advantages and disadvantages to it, and Phil had catalogued them all. But they were irrelevant, because Clint did things twice, and that wasn't going to change. Feeling Clint's weight settle on the other side of the bed, rolling over to wrap one arm around him so that his fingers came to rest curled against the archer's hip, he breathed in deeply, slowly. These were moments they didn't get very often, moments that were peaceful for them both. Phil worked. There was always one more action to authorize, one more press junket to deal with, one more near-death encounter to sign off on. It was difficult to find peace in the midst of all of it, but harder still for Clint, who was haunted not by his job, but by his mind. For Phil, it was paperwork and permissions and post-strike reconnaissance teams. For Clint, it was everything. Weapons to be checked, twice. Doors to be locked, twice. The way he had to check and recheck the clocks, the pauses while he stopped and redirected wayward thoughts, expression of pain clear on his face because he didn't want it, any of it. "Relabel," Phil would whisper to him then, sliding his arms around Clint's waist to give him something else to fixate on. "Reattribute, refocus, revalue." "Relabel," Clint would answer when he could, telling himself that everything was okay, the gun locker was sealed, nothing was going to go wrong, he didn't need to check it, he just thought he did. "Reattribute." "It's not your fault, Clint. It's okay." "Refocus." And it was usually around that time that Clint sighed and slumped against him, letting go of whatever compulsion he was fighting. "Revalue" was the hard one for him. Telling himself it didn't mean anything, didn't make him flawed, a failure, somehow less than everyone else. That was something Clint still had trouble managing. For Clint's sake, Phil wished he could take it all away. For the ability to watch the man he loved come in after a mission and throw himself down on the couch with the rest of the Avengers, instead of rocking anxiously back and forth on his heels until he could get away, tend to his gear, and shower. Twice. For the ability to hold him close at night without first having to go and find him on the shooting range, trying to quiet his mind enough for sleep. For Clint to be able to be himself without worrying about what the other Avengers might say, or how much of an inconvenience he was, or any one of the thousand things that went through his head to tear him down every time Phil tried to build him up. For Clint to believe, just once, that he could relax, and the world wouldn't go to hell around him because of it. But he couldn't. He couldn't take any of it away. And Clint... Clint was perfect, and Phil wouldn't change a single thing. He let a hand brush along Clint's arm and down, threading his fingers between Clint's, closing their hands together to occupy them with something besides drumming on the mattress. "Sorry," whispered Clint. "Was I..." "Only a little." He dropped a soft kiss into the tousled hair, feeling tension ebb from the muscles beneath him. "Go to sleep." Phil remembered figuring it out, because this wasn't something that was in Clint's files, wasn't something anyone had ever noticed before. When he was around other people, Clint did a damn good job of hiding it. He'd seen Clint's darting glances, his obvious lack of attention, when he'd done quick on-site debriefs after missions. And, just like everyone else, he'd attributed it to the man's low tolerance for paper-pushing and his dislike of authority. He'd seen Clint's brow wrinkle in concentration as he set his old standard-issue timepiece to synchronize with the team, catching Natasha's wrist and checking his watch against hers 2, 3, 4 times. And, just like everyone else, he'd assumed it was part of Clint's natural professionalism while on assignment. He'd seen his fingers, drumming on his leg or his coffee cup or the edge of his chair during every morning meeting. And, just like everyone else, he thought it was just Clint's annoyed impatience showing through. He remembered, time and again, "Barton, do you mind?" And the way the corners of Clint's mouth would tauten, the way he'd roll his eyes but also clamp his fingers around his mug and lock them there, white-knuckled, while Phil continued his rundown of recent events. Now, of course, he wished he could take back every time he'd said it, but he hadn't known, and Clint hadn't wanted him to. He remembered, too, the sudden realization after one too many missions. One too many target practice all-nighters. One too many times he'd snapped at Clint for disrupting a briefing session. Only this time Clint hadn't had a sarcastic comeback, or an eye-roll, or an exaggerated stretch back into a casual position, with an expansive gesture to continue. No, this time Clint had frozen, stared at him wide-eyed for a moment, and then gotten to his feet, stumbling out of the room with a muttered aside about not having time for this crap, They'd all stared as the door closed behind him, and then Natasha had sighed and made to go after him. To this day, Phil didn't know what had made him stop her and go after Clint himself instead. They'd still been in a sort of awkward standby phase, of being co-workers who weren't sure whether they wanted to despise each other or jump each other's bones. But somehow, Phil had ended up in the deserted upper-floor corridor of the helicarrier, watching Clint twitch and tick and swear under his breath, and give a half-open storage room door the kind of kick he'd never seen outside a combat situation. "Barton," he'd said. "Clint." A sharp intake of breath. Clint's shoulders tensed and drawn close, and he turned. "The hell you want, Coulson?" The look on his face had nearly stopped Phil in his tracks, but he pulled himself together and said, "Come back." Not meeting his eyes, Clint had leaned against the wall and said, "Nice of you to offer, but no, thanks." "The briefings are mandatory." "Some make an exception. You make them for Stark all the time." "Stark runs a company, and a sizable portion of the modern world. Come back." Clint had shaken his head, turned away again, muttered something Phil hadn't been able to hear. "I beg your pardon?" "I can't." And Phil had stopped right there, because Clint was serious about that. They'd stood there, each unsure of where to go from here, until Clint dared to glance up and Phil had locked eyes with him. 8 o'clock tomorrow, Barton. Be there." And he'd left. He hadn't answered any questions when he'd gotten back to the meeting, nor had he seen Clint for the rest of the day. Well, unless one took into consideration the fact that, having finally realized, he'd logged onto the security feeds for the shooting range that evening and watched Clint draw, over and over again, until he nearly fell asleep at his desk watching. The next morning, on the arm of Clint's customary chair in the briefing room, there'd been a stupid little toy, one of those keychain Rubik's Cubes you could get in a Happy Meal or at the dollar store. But Clint had known right away what it was for, and he twisted and turned it in his hands for the whole briefing, and Phil hadn't met his gaze or said a word about it. Clint hadn't said a word about it either, but the next time Phil had been up in the middle of the night, dealing with paperwork from the Avengers' latest mission, he'd appeared in the office doorway with two mugs of coffee and the Rubik's Cube, and he'd sat silently in Phil's office and fidgeted with it until Phil went to bed. At some point, Phil had stopped doing on-site debriefs at all, touching base with each of them through their comm units instead of requiring them to gather as a group. Full debriefs waited until after everyone had stowed their gear, showered, and changed. Twice, if they wanted. He never mentioned it again when Clint tapped out patterns on the arms of his chair during morning meetings. In his turn, Clint began to tap on his leg instead, or to play with the cube. Phil eventually realized, too, that every time he spent a late night in his office, the younger man appeared at his door with a cup of coffee for each of them. And though he spent the first few nights sitting quietly in a corner and twisting the Rubik's Cube, solving it and breaking it back up and solving it again, he was too restless to last for long that way, and it wasn't long before he ended up stalking around Phil's office, squaring all his papers off in neat, right-angled stacks. Phil just laughed and let him. They'd talk, and Clint came with coffee to distract Phil from his paperwork, or when Phil went down to the shooting range to remind Clint about food and sleep and other necessary things. Phil heard about the orphanage, the circus, all the things in Clint's file, but real this time. Numbers and dispassionate reports were replaced by the 5th birthday when Clint wanted a bicycle but got a black eye. The rough feel of the burlap blankets he and Barney slept under in their caravan at the circus. The way he'd felt on his first SHIELD-sanctioned assignment. Clint heard about Phil's fall from a tree when he was 7. About 16-hour days in the desert and army fatigues. About how many different ways there were to kill a man with half a ballpoint pen. They might even have come up with a few new ones. One night, they didn't stop talking when they got to the end of the hallway where they usually separated. Clint flopped down onto the floor of Phil's quarters and finished his story. Phil sat on his bed, not caring if his suit wrinkled, and listened. A few nights later, Phil interrupted a story of his own when they reached the end of the hallway, and Clint took the opportunity to lean in and kiss him. Twice. "You could get treatment," Phil had offered one day. "Yeah, screw that," had been Clint's simple response. "It might be easier." "I'm a sniper, Phil. All day long, I'm shooting things, and trying to make sure the things I'm shooting are my teammates. I'm not taking anything." Phil had wanted to say it might not be so bad, might even give him a break from everything, give him a chance to rest his overactive mind. Because it wore him out, Phil could see that easily. Clint had a hell of a stubborn streak, though, and in this case Phil could kind of see his point, so he opted instead for It doesn't have to be medication. There are therapies. You're kidding, right? I'm not doing some New Age talk about my feelings crap. That's not exactly how it works. No, thanks, Phil. And he knew when it was time to back off, so he just said, Okay, it's okay. Just wanted you to know that you could, if you wanted. That I would help you. That we could find a way that worked for you. That no one would think any less of you if you did. He hadn't really expected Clint to agree. It hadn't felt right not to mention the possibility to him, but Phil had been able to guess the outcome pretty accurately before he'd even said anything. Instead, he began to learn. He learned to redirect Clint's focus on difficult days. He learned what Clint needed to do and what he could overcome. He learned the difference between times when Clint was fine, and times when Clint was doing everything in his power to look like he was fine, and, when it was the latter, he learned what helped and what didn't. Clint confessed to him one day that when his brain took him in directions he didn't want to go, he recited poetry in his head until the obsessions faded a little. Phil asked him, Poetry? And Clint just rolled his eyes and said, What, I'm not allowed to have layers? Rather than answering, he asked another question. What is it like? What? This. The whole thing. Dealing with it all. It's... I don't know. His brow furrowed as he thought through Phil's question. Time-consuming, I guess. I mean, it's stupid. I don't need to do any of this crap, but if I don't... It just... It bothers me. Like turning off your radio in the middle of a mission. You can't think about anything else until you turn it back on and hear everyone's voices. It's like that. Hard to concentrate. Have to check everything first. Phil put out a hand, ripped gentle circles into Clint's back, through the thin fabric of his shirt. And if you can't? On assignment or something? Then I don't. But it's not great. What does it feel like? Clint sighed. It sucks. Can we not talk about this? Okay. And Phil drew him in close instead, arms closing around him, his head resting on Phil's shoulder. I'm sorry. No, Clint mumbled from his shoulder. It's okay. And then, softer, so that Phil wasn't even entirely sure he'd heard it. Thanks. You're welcome, Phil said. You're worth it, he meant. It happened sometimes. Assignments went bad. They had to throw out their original plans and ad lib. This wasn't the first time, and it wouldn't be the last. And it worked. It always did. And Thor and Tony kept a running tally of their knockouts over the comms channel. And Natasha's total somehow exceeded both of theirs. And the Hulk took out a tank and was disqualified from competition. And when they all gathered after the worst of the street-level fighting, to try to decide how to approach the underground base, it was Steve who realized that Clint wasn't answering his radio. Where's Hawkeye? He asked, and no one was sure. HQ? He tried. And Phil, who had been frantically going through the last few minutes of satellite feeds, steadied his voice enough to say, I can't confirm a visual. Okay, he told himself. Standard procedure. Back up 10 minutes, try again. It was easy to miss. Too easy. Easy enough that Phil hadn't even seen it when it happened. Easy enough that he would have missed it again if he hadn't been looking so hard for it. Since as hyper-acute as they scanned every second of the footage, slowed down to a frame per second so nothing could be overlooked. Hydra, he said over the comms. Took him 13 minutes ago from the secondary vantage point. 13 minutes, 30 seconds, he thought. 31, 32. He was accustomed to precision. He was accustomed to Clint. You think they have him in the base, Coulson? It's likely. From now on, consider this a retrieval mission. And with that, he signed off, pulled a heavily protected shield laptop from the bottom drawer of his desk, and left the building without authorization. If this was a retrieval mission, then he sure as hell intended to be on site for it. The Hulk was on point, providing a distraction because, well, because he was big and green and capable of punching a lot of things very quickly. Their plan, hastily assembled, was no more detailed than break into cell blocks, find Hawkeye, extract. And with Bruce on the street, and Steve leading a squad of SHIELD agents into the operating centers of the base, that left Iron Man to take the cell block on the right, and Thor to tackle the one on the left. Phil was staying at street level, laptop and earpiece in place, monitoring Thor's and Tony's audio feeds, as well as the visual Jarvis gave him from the suit. On the surface, he was cool, calm, collected. His one concession to events was that his tie was a fraction looser than usual. Clint would have noticed, but no one else did. Inside, though, his heart pounded. His thoughts everywhere, some automatic channel of his mind ticked off the seconds since Clint had been gone. 192 minutes, 19 seconds, 20, 21. Enough time to get S.H.I.E.L.D. out here in force. Give everyone a job. Synchronize watches. To Jarvis, because as long as they were all running on Jarvis' time, they'd all be running on Clint's time. And for some reason that seemed important. And go. Sometimes Phil loathed proper procedure. Today, he wanted to ignore every instruction he'd ever been given. Tunnel into the base with his bare hands. Find Clint. And drop anything else that moved. He might have done it, too, if Thor and Tony hadn't chosen that moment to breach the base's outer defenses and move in. Thor kept up a running commentary as he penetrated his cell block, announcing all the places where Clint was not, as he effortlessly dispatched anyone who came up against him. Tony, for once, was quieter, letting the visual feed do his talking for him when he wasn't whiting out the screen with his repulsor blasts. It was Tony who found Clint in the end. 233 minutes, 9 seconds. And all the air left Phil's lungs at once when he saw him. 4 hours. 4 hours missing, that should be nothing. All operatives were trained to go much longer, trained in resistance to interrogation. And though Clint had a weakness and emotional pride and ego down, he was as close-mouthed in the face of danger as any agent Phil had ever seen. But this wasn't right. Something was wrong. Clint didn't just look like he'd been through 4 hours of questioning, not even through 4 hours of torture. He was in a cell, chained half-slumped against the wall, his arms splayed wide. There was dirt, blood. Clint was sweat-streaked, and his wrists were raw, where they had rubbed against the cuffs. He was a mess, and he looked like he'd been down there for a week, but it wasn't any of that that set off all of Phil's alarms. The unfocused gaze did, the way Clint's eyes darted everywhere, not landing long enough even to register Tony's form kneeling in front of him. His fingers, opening and closing helplessly against the cuffs, trying to tap patterns against each other, because there was nothing else to use. His lips, parted slightly as he whispered something Tony's mic didn't pick up, on and on without pause. His missing watch. "Get those cuffs off him!" And Phil hadn't meant for his reaction to be so knee-jerk, and technically it was Captain Rogers who gave orders in the field. But none of that mattered, and Phil was already tossing the laptop into the back seat of the Acura, grabbing a more portable earpiece, and heading for the ruined base. By the time he arrived, Tony had the cuffs in several pieces on the floor, rubbing the circulation back into Clint's hands, and Clint was trying to push him away, pulling his hands back to his sides and scrambling awkwardly back so that Tony couldn't catch hold of him again. He was still talking, and Phil caught snatches of it. Horror, menace, unafraid. But without stopping to listen, Phil just reached out and wrapped Clint up in his arms, giving him something safe to feel, giving him some way to ground himself so that he could try to fight whatever was happening in his head. Clint's hands closed on his arms, and he felt fingers tapping soft rhythms against his skin. "Captain of my soul," Clint whispered, and then, "Phil." "It's okay. I'm here." Never mind that Tony was still watching them. Never mind that this put paid to any leverage he had over Tony and Steve with regard to workplace fraternization. Never mind any of it. He had more important things to worry about right now. "I need... again." "Go on." "Even numbers." Reciting poetry might have helped until they could reach him, but Clint couldn't stop yet. 4 lines in, Tony started to say something about getting out of there, and Phil just held up one hand in his direction, shaking his head, and waited for Clint to finish. "When he did," Phil said, "Clint." And then again, "Clint." "It's okay," Clint said, pushing back, standing on his own. "Not gonna lose my mind today." But his voice was weak, and Phil, filing the comment away for later, could hear the strain in it, Clint holding on by a thread. No idea what was going on. No. Oh. He took off his watch and wrapped it gently around Clint's wrist, fastening it loosely to avoid irritating the raw skin. "Still synced," he smiled, and tapped its face, and Clint checked it once, twice. "Thanks." And then suddenly, he was shaking violently, and Phil grabbed him again before he could end up falling. "Relabel," he muttered. This wasn't an obsession, nothing like it. It was just stress and release, and the blind effort of having spent the last 4 hours without any means of relief, and desperately needing it. The routine was familiar. Necessary or not, it would help. "Relabel," Clint said back to him, closing his eyes. "Relabel. Reattribute." They went through all of it, Clint saying and doing everything twice, because he had to. He'd gone 4 hours with no control at all, and he needed, now, to get it back. And it was only when they'd finished, the restless tapping of Clint's fingers easing into a strong grip on Phil's arms, the words fading to a halt, that Phil met Tony's eyes over the top of Clint's head and nodded. Hauling Clint outside was easier with two. Tony could have carried him alone and faster, but he didn't even bother suggesting that Phil leave Clint with him, because it was obvious that that wasn't going to happen. As it was, everyone was back on the street, clustered around one of the ops vehicles, by the time they emerged from what remained of the Hydra cell block. One clipped command sent Tony for debrief. One outstretched hand claimed a bottle of water from the support tech, and Phil dumped it over his handkerchief, the one Clint always made fun of, and started to wipe the dirt and the blood from Clint's hands and face. Clint knew better than to try to help, knew he would only hinder things, so he just let Phil work in silence and without protest. It was a while before all of their cleanup concerns were addressed, and S.H.I.E.L.D. began to clear the area. A medtech tried to offer to transport Clint home. Phil knew even before he finished his sentence how well that was going to work out, because he'd never yet seen Clint in the infirmary without his having had to be manhandled down there by at least one of his teammates. There would normally have been a smart remark, some kind of snappy comment that lent credence to his argument that he was fine. But this time Clint just met Phil's eyes and said, "No. Not now. No. I'll take responsibility for him from here," Phil told the medic, as if he hadn't been all along, and signed the forms they handed him. "Happy will take you." He jumped, spun, and Tony was standing beside him, still in the Iron Man armor, but with his helmet cradled in one arm. With the other, he was gesturing to the sleek Rolls-Royce waiting by the curb. Phil looked at him, and knew that this was something he'd have to deal with, but later. For now, he just nodded his thanks, and began helping Clint to the car. "What do you need?" It was a question Phil asked every hour of every day. "To superior officers. What does your objective require from the Avengers Initiative?" "To government officials." "What is your level of security clearance for this information?" "To Director Fury." "What cover story do you want me to give them this time, sir?" But never to Clint, because Clint wouldn't admit he needed things. Clint, fresh from a shower, and what little medical attention he'd allowed Phil to provide, shook his head and dropped onto the bed. "Nothing. Just, I'm going to grab a couple hours sleep." "I'm fine, Phil." "That works on Fury," Phil pointed out. "Not on me." He could see that Clint's eyes were still not right, still not entirely back to reality, but he could also see the layers of exhaustion that lay behind them, and maybe sleep would make the difference. There was something he had to take care of, too. "Will you be all right if I go out for a little while?" Clint nodded and gave a dismissive wave, valiantly trying to look unconcerned. For all his posturing, though, his gaze was worried, fixed on Phil. "Are you sure?" Phil asked, because he obviously wasn't. "What's wrong?" He had to lean close to hear the whispered answer, too quiet for him to catch the first time Clint said it. "How long?" Phil looked at the bedside clock. "Not more than 15 minutes. He held up the watch, tucked into his pocket when Clint had gone to shower. "Do you want me to leave this with you?" Another nod, so he placed it on the nightstand where Clint could reach it, taking the opportunity to lean just a little farther over and press a kiss to Clint's forehead. 15 minutes, he said softly. "I promise." As soon as the door had closed behind him, he glanced up at the ceiling, a pointless instinct, but one he hadn't bothered to break nonetheless. "Jarvis," he said, "I need you to tell me when 12 minutes have gone by. Margins of error were important." "Yes, sir." "Right. Okay. Next order of business, Tony Stark." He was in his workshop, of course. He was always in his workshop after an assignment, tweaking and adjusting the armor to address anything they'd encountered in the field. Today it was repulsors again, something about narrow beam efficiency and multifunctionality. Phil rarely paid attention to the particulars when Tony was talking, preferring to wait for his written reports so that he could peruse at his leisure. With no reason not to be blunt, he made his request straight up. "I'd like to keep what happened in the base between us." "Between us?" "Let's say I'd prefer if it didn't find its way into anyone's field reports." Tony looked doubtfully at him. After all, it wasn't as though they were exactly the closest of friends. And yet here Phil was, standing before him and asking a favor. Then again, it was a favor that meant going behind Shield's back, and that, at least, might appeal to Tony a little. No such luck. Tony frowned. This could be a liability in the field. It could be dangerous. Does Fury know about this? Does Steve know about this? Steve's the goddamn team leader. Shouldn't the leader of the Avengers know about this? No. And it came out a bit more forcefully than intended. So Phil paused, collected his thoughts, and continued. This is Agent Barton's prerogative and his alone. Has he ever let it be an issue on an assignment? No, but... And he never will. Phil knew it was true. Clint was many things, but most of all determined. And when he was on assignment, there was nothing he wouldn't do to ensure it went off without a hitch. Tony looked at him again, expression serious, and Phil could see him calculating. On the one hand, it was Clint's right to decide who knew about this and when, but on the other hand, it was also a legitimate concern if something happened in the field. On the one hand, Tony liked to needle Clint, but on the other hand, even Tony could see that going over Clint's head on this went beyond needling. On the one hand, it was Phil asking the favor, and there was nothing Tony enjoyed more than finding ways not to do what Phil asked of him. But on the other hand, he and Clint were teammates, and there was a level of trust involved in that that Tony couldn't just ignore. Without tearing his gaze from Phil's, Tony slowly nodded his understanding. Between us. Thank you. Sir, Jarvis spoke up when he was in the hallway leading to his quarters. It has been 12 minutes exactly. Thank you, Jarvis. And that was good. He'd worried he might have to leave the workshop before he had finished with Tony. Instead, he opened his door, quietly in case Clint was asleep already, and slipped inside. Not asleep. He could tell from the rhythms of Clint's breathing, from the minute shifts in his position on the bed, and then from veiled eyes watching him through the darkness. Less than a minute later, he chucked off his suit and hung it up, shirt landing crumpled in the laundry hamper, and he was curling up around Clint on the bed. You okay? Yeah. And then something quieter, something spoken less clearly. Didn't catch that. I'm sorry, Clint mumbled. Didn't mean... No, said Phil. Don't apologize. You didn't do anything wrong. Couldn't move my hands, he tried to explain. And I lost the watch. Tony can build another one. I'll put in an asset status report. The archer nodded wearily. Gonna stay here tonight? Of course. Hey, because there was one thing Phil wanted to talk to him about. You said something earlier about losing your mind. Silence stretched across the room as Clint drew and held a shaky breath, waiting for the rest. Is that something you worry about? A shrug, just a half second too late to be casual. How much crazier can I get? That was what he'd been afraid of. Clint, you're not crazy. I recited a poem non-stop today for 4 hours. I can't lock a door without checking it a dozen times. My watch is a fucking atomic clock. I think I qualify. And Tony wears a suit of armor powered by his heart. Bruce turns into a green-skinned monster when he's angry. Thor still calls coffee, mead of the Midgardian minor gods. I think I can say with some authority that you're not crazy, Clint. In fact, you're one of the most normal people I know. Yeah, Clint said with another shrug. Whatever. But his tone of voice was almost normal now, and he shifted more securely into Phil's arms as he said it. And that was something, anyway. I love you, he whispered, the warm weight comforting in his arms. I know, Clint whispered back. I love you too. I love you too. The end. Your stance is the foundation. Part 2 of the Mindset series. Please note that this fic has trigger warnings for discussion of mental health issues and bullying. Chapter 1. It happens in the space of an indrawn breath, between the widening of Phil's eyes as he slides his hands down to Clint's wrists for better grip, and the beginning of a laugh that dies in his throat when he feels Clint seize up underneath him, Before Phil has even had time to register anything beyond not good, he's flung his hands wide out to both sides, non-threatening, and Clint is scrambling away from him, back out of his reach. It's only a second or two before they're staring at each other across the 6-foot gap, breathing hard. Clint's chest is heaving, arms wrapped protectively around himself as his adrenaline-washed gaze meets Phil's. Phil gives him time before asking, "What happened?" Simple, bland, unemotional. He's information gathering, not judging. And the wild look leaves Clint's eyes a little as he drops his arms and sidles a few inches closer to Phil. Just don't grab me like that, okay? He manages. And even as the rational part of Phil's brain takes notes. No wrists, no arms behind his back. The other part, the part where Clint is already deeper ingrained than Phil is comfortable admitting, is cursing him for not having thought of that in advance. There's no way he could have anticipated this, of course. But then, that's why this isn't the rational part of his brain. He wants to ask why. Wants to know what happened to Clint to make him go from laughing, wrestling, mischievous sparks in his eyes, to this, with just one touch. But this thing they have is still new, and apprehensive, and fragile. And Phil's not sure he's earned the right to ask those questions yet. They'll get there, if he's careful and learns from mistakes like this. "Is this okay?" he asks, closing the gap between them and slipping one arm around Clint's shoulders. Clint leans into him, yielding to the touch. "It's fine," he says. "It's good. But there's one problem." "What?" Phil asks, poised, waiting, ready to back away if Clint asks him to. "It's unprotected," Clint says, and his grin flickers back to life as he launches himself at Phil. Chapter 2. Phil hates it when they encounter incompetent villains. It just makes for so much extra paperwork. They're sitting on the floor of Phil's room, against the side of the bed, and Clint's doctoring his wrists. The people, and Phil hesitates to use the word, they've taken down this time, had him too tightly locked in old handcuffs, discards from police forces long since updated to safer technology. Clint's wrists are rubbed raw over the bones, bruises shading the skin dark around the bloodied areas. His arms are sore from being pulled around, Phil knows, and it's slow going as he tries to clean the cuts one-handed. He knows he shouldn't ask to help, but he does anyway. "I'm fine," Clint says, not looking up from the iodine wipe he's trying to use without making things worse. So Phil just sits and watches him. The bandages are another matter, though, and it's as Clint is awkwardly trying to keep the end of one in place, and straighten it out, and wrap it all at the same time, that Phil says, "Clint." He stops. "Let me help you." Clint looks at him sidelong, and Phil can see his fingers gripping the bandage, sinking in so that stray pieces of gauze escape and fall across white knuckles. "Let me help you." The second offer is a reminder. "I understand. We can work with this." And they both know that. Clint does things twice. He doesn't need Phil to do it, but it's a way to say that they're in this together. Clint lets go of the bandage, hugs his arms to his stomach and curls around them, holding Phil's gaze but sending a clear message. "Not okay." Phil raises his eyebrows, holds out his hands helplessly, sends one right back. "Why?" They sit, neither one speaking, neither one moving to do anything, until Clint's shoulders drop in a sigh, head falling forward so he's staring at the floor in front of him. "You've read my files." "I read everyone's files." "I had a brother." Phil knows that, although he doesn't know much more about it. Clint's files have no names under next of kin, just a shield notification number to call if he's ever neutralized. His one surviving family member is not a part of his life anymore, and Phil hasn't tried to find him, because Clint obviously wants to keep it that way. "At the orphanage, at school, the other kids would catch me. You know, doing stuff." Phil can guess. Checking everything in his bunk, or testing the handles of locked doors, or trying to peer through the windows of the school during recess to see the clocks, because he would have had to know, needed to know, what time it was. He thinks of Clint, skinny and 10 years old maybe, trying to cope and having no way, and his heart breaks a little for it. "And they'd surround me, you know, so I couldn't run, and tell me they were going to take away all the clocks so that I couldn't see them anymore. And I was a stupid kid, I believed them." He's hunched over more than ever now, arms tight around himself, and it's a position Phil's getting uncomfortably accustomed to seeing. He wants to reach out right now and pull Clint out of his protective shell. Prove to him that he's safe here. That he can let down his guard. But that kind of proof takes time. And then they started to tease Barney, too, Clint says with effort. And Barney was older, and they were bullies, so he had a choice. Phil knows what's coming before Clint says it. Hurt me or get hurt. So Clint tells him about the way Barney would point it out loudly to the other kids, whenever he saw Clint twitching or ticking. The way, when he noticed fingers drumming on Clint's leg, he'd yell in a near-perfect imitation of their father, "Stop the goddamn tapping!" And the way, when Clint didn't, couldn't, he'd grab Clint's wrists and pull his hands behind his back, holding too tight, hurting his little brother's shoulders. And Clint would struggle and scream and cry. But Barney was older and stronger, and Clint couldn't get away from him. And eventually Clint got older, too. And he learned that the trick was just to hang on long enough for the kids to get bored. That if he bit his lip until it bled, and closed his eyes, and counted under his breath, two by two, they'd lose interest and leave him alone. It took longer for Barney than for anyone else. But eventually, even Barney would drop his hands and give him a rough shove, and then Clint could get away. Clint doesn't tell him about creeping away into a hidden corner of the schoolyard, shaking and pressing his face into his sleeve so that he didn't cry. He doesn't tell Phil about tapping his fingers against the schoolyard fence, and counting under his breath, and shaking his head hard enough that it hurt, until he didn't feel like he was going to explode. He doesn't tell Phil any of those things, but Phil guesses at them anyway, and sits there in front of Clint without words, and aches. When Clint runs out of words, or breath, or bravery, they're quiet together. The iodine wipes are forgotten, bleeding brown onto the carpet from one corner of the first aid kit. The bandage Clint was trying to apply lies half unrolled on the floor by his knee. Phil's never moved as slowly or as cautiously as he does now, reaching out for the medical supplies and sorting them out with silent practicality. The job is done before he breaks the silence, and when he does, it's with a bandage in his hand and a calm, serious look in his eyes that Clint recognizes. "Clint," he says, "let me help you." Even though he's asked, even though it's the only practical way to get this done, it still almost knocks the air out of him when Clint bites the inside of his lip and mutters, "Go ahead." Phil takes Clint's hand and wraps the bandage carefully around his wrist. It's nothing. It's one field agent patching up another after a mission. It's perfectly ordinary. Happens all the time. It's nothing. It's everything. Chapter 3. He finds it online, a day or two after he begins to look up terms and definitions, symptoms and reactions, treatments and therapies. Phil is good at paperwork of any kind. It's how he approaches problems, and it's his best bet for approaching this one as well. There are neat ruled lines along his pages, thin block letters heading up each new section, margin notes in narrow, sloping handwriting. This one gets its own page, divided into four sections. Relabel, reattribute, refocus, revalue. Clint comes into his office that night around 9 o'clock, sets a cup of coffee down in front of him, and straightens the papers Phil has stacked up around himself. This is where taking notes on a yellow legal pad has its downfall, because Clint finds it, looks at it, then looks at Phil. "What's this for?" he asks, already knowing the answer. Phil shrugs. "I was just doing some research," he says. Clint's face is carefully blank as he skims the pages of neat writing. When he reaches the last page, he tears them all off the notepad, folds them over, once, twice, and drops them in Phil's recycling bin. His meaning is obvious. "I don't need this." Phil frowns at the discarded sheets. "It's not for you," he says. "It's for me. For my own peace of mind." There's a hesitation, and Phil takes the opportunity to retrieve the papers from the recycling. "Fine," Clint growls softly. "But I don't want to hear a word about it." For weeks, Phil keeps that promise. He watches Clint have good days and bad ones. Watches him struggle and succeed. Clint's right. He does a damn good job of coping and accounting for his issues. And if Phil didn't know what he was looking for, he wouldn't be seeing it at all. Phil hates looking at Clint on harder days and knowing he could help. That's what eventually does him in, setting aside his paperwork at nearly 3 in the morning and finding an empty bed in his quarters. Clint's still down at the range, then. Target practice he began 8 hours ago. The target is in tatters, and Phil steps into the room. And Clint's still knocking, drawing, firing, without cease. There's blood on his left hand, because Clint doesn't know when to say enough is enough. Phil waits until his quiver is empty before approaching, and it's only as he gets within arm's reach that he sees Clint's lips moving just a fraction. Hears the low mutter of words he can't discern. Clint's eyes lock on his, and it's the haunted look in them that breaks Phil's resolve, not to mention anything he's read online. Clint's asking, "Help me," as clearly as if he were saying it, except that Clint would never, ever use those words. He lays his hands on Clint's shoulders, pressure firm and steady because that helps. This isn't something he's read about. He sees it every night, when Clint relaxes in his arms, hears of his mind slowing as he focuses his world down to Phil and nothing else. Without taking his eyes from Clint's, Phil says, "Relabel." "What?" "Relabel," he repeats. "Slow down. Stop panicking. They're just thoughts, Clint." Clint doesn't know what's going on here, but Phil's come to get him, and the weight of his arms is helping, and the calmness of his expression is helping, and the rhythm of his words is helping. So Clint nods. "Relabel." "Reattribute." "Reattribute?" "Just thoughts. Not your fault." Clint mumbles. "I get stuck sometimes." "I know. Not your fault." "Reattribute," Clint whispers. "Not my fault." "Refocus. Think about something else. Do something else." A twitch in the direction of the target. Half hanging off the wall beside them, it's been shot so many times. But Clint's eyes still don't leave Phil's. That seems like it might be all that's grounding him right now. "Like what?" "Like this. Revalue." "Revalue." By now, Clint is automatically repeating what Phil says, waiting for an explanation he knows is coming. "It's not you, Clint. It's just misfiring." "I never misfire." Phil smiles. "I know. See? It's not you." Clint smiles back, just a little. "I never misfire." And Phil has to reach out and pull him close for that. For the smile. For the trust. For the repetition Clint only allows himself when the two of them are alone. "Relabel," Clint says into the creased fabric of Phil's shirt. "Reattribute. Refocus. Revalue." "Helps?" Phil asks, though he's pretty sure he knows the answer already. Clint nods into his shoulder. "Hmm," he says absently. "Helps. Let's go to bed." He doesn't question Phil's online research anymore after that. Chapter 4. Clint gets injured a lot. Phil's used to that by now. Keeps a first aid kit in his office, and another in their quarters. Knows when to manhandle Clint down to the infirmary, and when to let him take care of things himself. Reacts with equanimity when Clint shows up in front of him all blood and dust, and chunks of New York sidewalk in his hair. That's normal for them these days. When Phil gets injured, Clint doesn't deal with it very well. To be fair, Clint usually shows up still walking, still conscious, laughing as he staunches the flow of blood from a wound somewhere. He doesn't come home like this, carried in Thor's arms, still and pale and silent in the echoing emptiness of the mansion without him. The mansion sounds the same as ever. It's Clint who can't hear it, over the strange rushing silence that suddenly fills his ears, and threatens to drown out his entire brain. He runs behind Thor, all the way to the infirmary, follows the doctors as they take Phil into emergency care, pushes his way through the doors until someone holds up a hand and tells him he can't go any farther. Then he finds a partially hidden corner. Good enough. And lets his fingers drum against the stainless steel floor of the medical bay. Lets his face twitch with involuntary tics. Lets himself whisper under his breath, "In Xanadu did Kubla Khan." It's Phil's favorite poem. He checks his new watch every few seconds, until he sees them move Phil again, then trails behind them to the room where they leave him. That's wrong, somehow, he thinks. Shouldn't they be keeping an eye on Phil? Shouldn't there be some kind of medical authority around? No one comes in for 5 minutes, 10, 20, and Clint edges away from the wall. An hour, and he's sitting in the chair by the bed, fingers loosely clasped around Phil's wrist. It's okay. He's learning to reclaim that kind of touch. Feeling the pulse thrum in the thin tendons, when an orderly comes in and checks Phil's stats. Clint wants to know what's going on, so he asks. He's got to wake up sometime, right? Not for a while, the orderly says. He's under sedation orders till tomorrow. Oh, is all Clint says to that. All night. How often do you check on him? Once every hour, is the answer. And Clint sets the fancy multi-channel timer on the atomic watch to count the seconds off. When the orderly leaves, he considers for a moment, then decides he gives absolutely no fucks what the medical staff think, and crawls up onto the bed beside Phil. Laying his head against Phil's chest, cautiously, gently, because he's still not quite clear on just how badly Phil was hurt, is so much better than his fingers on Phil's wrist. The beat is more than just a faint sensation now. It fills his mind, driving away the things he doesn't want to think, the things he doesn't want to have to do. Phil calms him. Even unconscious, Phil is good for him. It hits him low and deep in his stomach when he thinks that, because he'll never, ever be completely over the old fear. Not good enough. Not strong enough. Not compliant enough. Phil, conscious, pushes away the worry and kisses him calm. Unconscious, Clint still needs him so much that he doesn't know what would happen to him if Phil ever decided that those doubts might have some foundation in truth. You know, he whispers into Phil's heartbeat, I don't know what I'd do if I lost you. His watch ticks off the minutes. Phil, never, he says, even softer now. Ever, ever do that again. I'm the one that gets hurt, not you. His watch ticks off the minutes. This isn't something he should say to Phil before he wakes. It's easier this way, though. Just for the first time. I love you, Phil. His watch ticks off the minutes. Phil's heart beats steadily. They're going to be okay. The end. Follow and master basic steps. Part 3 of the Mindset series. Please note that this fic has trigger warnings for discussion of mental health issues. Clint is terrible about paperwork. Not terrible in the way that Tony is, negligent and messy. Not terrible in the way that Bruce is, forgetful and scattered. Not terrible in the way that Natasha is, handwriting so tiny and precise that it's almost impossible to read. And then she switches to Cyrillic, and Phil sighs and pulls out an old magnifying glass. His Russian is fluent, of course, but he prefers not to have to use it on reports for missions that have taken place entirely within the continental United States. No, Clint is terrible in an entirely different way. He does his paperwork. Phil watches him sometimes, sitting at the dining room table when the others are all sparring or on combat drills, or anywhere where they won't disturb him. He fills in all the numbered blanks at the top of the page. Name, location, date. And then the time, down to the second, because Clint always knows the time to the second. His handwriting is unexpected, straight lines clean and dark against the page, and it's only after watching him 3 or 4 times that Phil notices his knuckles white against the pen and realizes just how hard he's gripping it. It's when he gets to Section 10, the mission summary itself, that Clint stops writing, all the header information filled out and ready to go. Phil's watched him then, too, tapping his pen against the table and then discarding it in favor of his fingers. Whispering words to himself, then stopping, staring at the ceiling and back down at his report, running his hands through his hair and tugging on the short strands that stay trapped between his fingers. Clint always starts his mission reports early, and yet Phil never sees them. That's not entirely accurate. He never sees them in an official capacity. Sometimes, though, after Clint has given up on the reports and disappeared into the basement where Phil knows he'll find him taking target shots hours later, he goes into the dining room and finds the crumpled remains of 2 or 3 half-finished reports in the recycling bin. He's wondered before if maybe this is hard for Clint. He spent most of his life just trying to survive, trying to stay hidden and manage to cope, and it's not a very conducive environment to learning. Phil wants to be understanding if that is what's going on, but whenever he retrieves the balled-up reports from the garbage, they're always neatly written and well summarized, at least until they cut off abruptly in the middle, and Clint crosses out most of the words with a thick, angry line. Fury notices, after a while, that the completed mission briefs Phil submits to him don't contain reports from Agent Barton. Is he giving you trouble? He asks. And Phil shrugs it off as just another one of the Avengers' many quirks. No need to worry, sir. Fury asks. Do I need to schedule a meeting? And Phil shakes his head. No, I'll speak to him. There's one last parting shot across Phil's bow before he leaves. A calm statement issued with folded hands and look full of expectation. Agent Coulson, I assigned you to the Avengers Initiative because I assumed you could keep them all in line. Phil promises again to speak to Agent Barton, and leaves in a hurry. Fury's office door closes behind him, but he can still swear he feels that gaze against the back of his neck as he walks away. He waits, because he's not sure what might be a good time for this kind of conversation. He's used to having work-related conversations with Clint in his office. Once they had one in the break room. That's not a mistake Phil ever plans to make again. Serious conversations happened elsewhere. On the shooting range at midnight. In the bedroom in the early morning, fuzzy with the last remnants of sleep. Over the comms on a mission meant to last 16 hours, that turned into 34. Phil's learnt by now how to have those talks. That Clint needs time and space and an escape route. That he needs to repeat himself without pressure. That he needs to line up all his phrases in his head before he says them. It still takes Phil's breath away when he does it, because the sheer amount of effort Clint puts into saying what he means is a side of him Phil never used to see. He's not sure what kind of conversation this one is, and so he waits. In the meantime, he turns in mission brief packets the same way he always has. Fury's stare is a little more significant every time. Finally, he decides, to hell with it, pulls the latest few crumbled-up balls of mission report from the recycling bin in the dining room, and takes them with him down to the basement. Let's talk about this. Clint sees what he's holding up, the papers with the wrinkles smoothed out just enough for recognizability, and rolls his eyes. Yeah, I'll write another one or something. Fury getting on your ass about it? Ignoring the question, Phil says. I'm not asking you to write another one. What I'm curious about is why you didn't write this one. The report he's holding isn't completed, but everything that's been written makes perfect sense, is efficiently phrased, is good. Clint's good at this. Instead of answering, Clint turns back to his target and puts 9 rapid arrows through it. It takes less than 30 seconds, and then he's fired 9 more, and Phil blinks, afraid that if he keeps his eyes closed for too long, he'll miss another round. When Clint finishes, there are 36 arrows in the target, and no more left in his quiver. So he puts the bow down gently and says, to the target, I'm not a fan of busy work. I do my job. This is part of your job, Phil points out. New York won't collapse if I don't find my sit reps on time. Or at all. That's not what I'm asking. Clint says, quietly. So get to the point. He doesn't mean it angrily. Probably doesn't mean it at all, Phil thinks. But he's a master of defensiveness, and this is just another way to push against the edges of something tight and uncomfortable. Why don't you ever finish them? One hand reaches out and wraps protectively around the bow. The other makes an abortive gesture over Clint's shoulder, reaching for the arrows that aren't there. Phil watches his fingers tighten on the riser of the bow until they're bloodless, index finger tapping out a rhythm Phil can't catch, watches his eyes dart around the room until they settle on the door, and Phil steps to one side so that there's a clear path. They don't always make it through an entire conversation before Clint needs to escape. Phil hasn't yet learned all the whys behind that, but he knows enough to make sure there is always a way out. Those ones aren't put together right. What that means, Phil cannot fathom. They look fine to me. They aren't right. The words don't measure properly. And that one. He takes one of the sheets out of Phil's hands, folds it up smaller and smaller as he talks. Too many marks. I couldn't. Too many mistakes. Phil files away the mistakes to deal with later, and says instead, measure properly? Clint nods. It doesn't sound right. It's uncomfortable. Sounds wrong. He skims the line, trying to hear the words in his head. Why? Syllables aren't even. Words just don't count outright. Rhythms. Phil pauses, thinking of the patterns Clint taps with his fingers, is still tapping even now, against the bow and the papers in his hands. He thinks about the way Clint evens things out, even numbers are better than odd, and the way he says the important things twice. He thinks about the poetry Clint uses when he can't derail his thoughts any other way, Wordsworth and Coleridge and Frost, and the way the words fall into rhythmic cadences in his mind as he says them to himself. He thinks maybe he's starting to get it just a little. The phrasing doesn't matter in the slightest. They're just field reports, just a way for Fury to be held accountable to someone. He knows that won't mean anything to Clint, though. Peace of mind to ordinary people means going to sleep at night with doors locked and protection at the ready. To the Avengers, it means having one another to rely on. To Phil, it just means having his paperwork turned in on time. And to Clint, peace of mind is this. The sorting of his world out into small, evenly spaced fragments. The ability to measure and control. Control is important. Phil can respect that. He wonders, absently, if this would be easier for Clint in Cyrillic. Instead, he asks, what if I read them? Huh? What if you debrief me orally after missions, and I write the reports? Debrief you orally, huh? Like the sound of that. But you're not doing my work for me, Phil. One of us has to. Yeah. I'll do it. It's fine. It's fine. It's fine. Phil thinks maybe this is the part where he takes a step back. Trusts Clint to know what he needs and what he's capable of doing. Remembers that he's not the only one who knows how to look after himself. So he does, literally, steps back and levers a warning look in Clint's direction. On my desk by noon tomorrow, Barton, he says. Or his fury you'll be dealing with, not me. An idle threat, and one he's given so many times by now that they both grin a little at it. But Clint gets it. Phil trusts him to deliver. I'm going to bed, he says. He is, but the statement is as much a reminder to Clint that sleep exists, as it is a report on his own plans. I'm going to stay down here a little while, okay? Phil wants to ask if Clint's all right, but he already knows the answer. With the one he'll get from Clint. I'm fine. I'm fine. And the one he sees himself. Fingers tapping on his bow, twitching with the need to knock and draw. Jaw set in an expression of determination. Tired eyes. He knows enough to back away, but not without pausing to run his fingers through the messy hair and rest them there for a moment. Enough pressure to be calming. Enough gentleness to tell Clint the things he won't yet say aloud. Clint ducks his head and grins. Tomorrow, Phil, I promise, he says. Go to sleep. Phil goes, and in the morning, there's Clint asleep at his side with his face tucked into Phil's shoulder, and there's a report on his desk that actually contains pertinent information for Dr. Fury, and there's even still coffee in the coffee maker. It's a pretty good day for them both. The end. Where You Draw Your Strength. Part 4 of the Mindset series. Please note that this fic has trigger warnings for discussion of mental health issues. Phil's got a visual on Clint Barton, and he doesn't like what he's seeing. Clint is on a harshly lit rooftop overlooking the nighttime street, bow drawn and crossbow at his feet. He looks poised and ready for action. Or, at least, he would if Phil didn't know better. Couldn't see his lips just barely moving as he mutters to himself. Couldn't see him occasionally break off and squeeze his eyes shut, like a small child counting out hide-and-seek. He turns up the gain on Clint's mic until it picks up a broken string of words. Keep it together, Clint. Got a mission. Eyes on the street. Yeah, that's it. Come on. In the full clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. The street, Clint, watch the goddamn street. Bloody, but unbowed. Street, Clint. Whatever's going on, it doesn't sound good. Phil frowns, gnaws on the ragged edge of a nail he's been swearing to himself for weeks he'll stop biting. He looks back just in time to catch Clint's hands jerk upward and hear him mutter, The mission, Clint, what the fuck are you good for anyway? Get your head in the goddamn game, you useless. And the archer pulls the mic from his earpiece and shoves it as far away from his mouth as he can, so that Phil, or whoever else he thinks might be on the headquarters end of the line, can't hear him anymore. Phil can't hear, but he can sure as hell see. He can see the edges of the bow riser cutting into Clint's hands where he's gripping it. He can see the set of Clint's jaw and the way the cords of his neck stand out. He can see when Clint's eyes flick away from the street below and up to the left, rapid calculations whispered loud enough that the mic picks up the trailing ends of them just a little. He sees when Clint puts down his bow on the concrete surface of the roof and presses the heels of his hands hard into his eyes. He sees those hands shaking, and he knows it won't end well if he leaves Clint out there like this. Abort, he says crisply into the mic at the computer. Barton, I want you back in here. Now. Sir, Barton says. Mission conditions are still ideal. I'm in charge of this operation, Phil replies. And that was a direct order, Agent Barton. Quint snaps his mouth shut so quickly, Phil can hear it over the mic. Seconds later, the air turned his gear have vanished from the rooftop, leaving no trace of the fact that they were ever there. Phil finds him at the door to the briefing room 45 minutes later, hair damp and tousled from the shower, thick shield hoodie pulled on over his clothes and zipped all the way up. His arms are crossed, fingers tapping out skittering patterns on his ribs, and Phil catches the last of his words. Barney. 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 As he stares at the closed door without seeing it and waits for debrief. He's not being debriefed in this state. Phil considers sending him to his quarters to rest, for about 5 seconds before his brain catches up, and tells him exactly how effective that will be. Come with me, he says. Quint shoots him a wary look, and really, what else should he have been expecting? Off-site, he explains. To my apartment. Quint's never been there before. Hell, Phil's hardly ever been there. It's a safe house, really. Just a cover story, nothing more. He lives at headquarters like the rest of the initiative. But unlike them, he has a bolt hole if he wants one. He doesn't particularly want one now, but he has a feeling Quint might, and the apartment has a pretty comfortable, plain, generic, couch. It's probably good for sleeping on. It takes them 4 minutes to get from the briefing room to Phil's car. 12 minutes to drive from S.H.I.E.L.D. headquarters to Phil's apartment. The traffic lights are in their favor. Phil rides the gas pedal a little hard, and Quint whispers, Barney, Barney. 3 more to climb the stairs to his floor. Quint's so tired he's stumbling a little. And 40 seconds to unlock the door. The lock sticks. Phil jiggles the key until he hits it at just the right angle. Quint times all of it. It's a mark of how worn out Quint is that he doesn't protest at all, and Phil steers him in the direction of the couch, and leaves him to fold in onto himself, alone in the quiet for a minute or two, while Phil rummages through his linen closet. As he's carrying in an armful of blankets, he hears Quint whispering again. Barney. 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 And, like the other times, it trails away into silence after a moment, leaving Quint looking more miserable than ever. What's that? He asks, gently. What's what? Clint returns, confused. Barney, Phil says, setting the blankets down on the couch. Why are you... saying my brother's name? Clint finishes for him, and Phil nods. There's a hesitation, and Phil is about to jump in. Remind Clint that he's under no obligations here. He doesn't have to answer. But Clint speaks before he can. I used to, back when all this started, Clint says, making a broad gesture at all of this that Phil understands without asking. I used to pretend it was someone else making me think those thoughts. I knew it wasn't. I'm not delusional. But it helped to act like it was. It helped. Helped you believe it wasn't your fault. Phil fills in the gaps, carefully not thinking about why it is his brother's name that Clint uses for this. Comes the almost negligent reply. But Clint nods. Phil's right. It was a way to shield himself from his own guilt and shame. And it worked. It still works. So now it's kind of a safe word, he explains. For when I need not to think something. It's faster than poetry. Like an emergency button. You've been saying it a lot today, Phil observes. Yeah, Clint agrees, but doesn't elaborate. Phil doesn't push. That's the last thing Clint needs right now. Instead, he nudges the stack of blankets in Clint's direction. Take what you need, he says. Means far more than the blankets, but doesn't say so, and Clint doesn't move. Phil hesitates for a moment, deliberating between leaving to give Clint some space and staying to make yet another misguided attempt at helping. But then he sees Clint twitch, blink his eyes tightly shut, and whisper sharply, Barney. That makes his decision for him. He sits. He also makes sure that the pile of blankets is next to him, solid physical barrier between him and Clint, so that there's no danger of overstepping boundaries. He doesn't really know what to do, other than that, but he's trying to make this a safe space, whatever that really means, and he's hoping Clint will take it from there. Maybe he isn't being direct enough. What do you need? He asks. Clint, eyes still closed, mutters something he doesn't catch. He leans closer. Say something, Clint tells him hoarsely. Anything, doesn't matter. Distract me. Phil considers for a few seconds. You owe me 17 missing mission reports, he says, because it's all he can think of, Because it's true, at any rate. It makes Clint laugh, although it skips beats and doesn't sound quite like laughter, and his fist curls into the blankets so that the fabric pillows around his fingers. I'll get right on that. Really? Phil asks. Because if so, you also owe me 17 expense reports, not to mention 4 munitions requisitions and, Clint, over 100 asset status reports. Over 100. I owe you 100 things of paperwork? For as long as I've been working for S.H.I.E.L.D., no team has ever lost or destroyed as many items as the Avengers Initiative. Isn't that going to be hell for you? I would be worried if I thought you were ever going to turn any of it in. This time, the laughter sounds a little more like it's approaching something natural. Not there yet, but Clint's fingers relax on the blanket just enough that the skin on his knuckles isn't white and bloodless anymore. Just enough that Phil can't see the tension in the tendons of his hands. He wants to ask if it's helping, talking about trivial things like paperwork. But asking seems like it would defeat the purpose, so he stays quiet. It occurs to him to wonder when over 100 missing documents became trivial to him. He thinks it might have happened about the time he brought Clint over to his house to get some sleep, instead of leaving him at S.H.I.E.L.D. headquarters. Or maybe about the time he sat down on the couch instead of heading for his own room. He also thinks it might have happened much earlier than that. But that's a possibility he'll wait to touch with careful fingers when Clint's there beside him. Not before. Not now. Clint hasn't said anything in a minute or two, so he remembers, distract me, and says, Do you speak Latin? It earns him a significant look, because of course Clint doesn't speak Latin. That might not matter as a distraction, though, so Phil says. Amissa solus palma superaba de cestis, qui tamen aerias telum contendit in auras, ostentans artemque pater arcunque sonantem. What's that? Virgil, Phil tells him. The Aeneid. What's it mean? Phil smiles and says, Acestus, grudging at his lot, remains, without a prize to gratify his pains. Yet shooting upward sends his shaft to show, an archer's art, and boast his twanging bow. It's an archery competition. Do you want to hear the rest? Clint nods. In English or in Latin? Both. Is the answer. Twice. So Phil keeps going. Hic oculi subitum obigitur menioque futurum, augurio monstrum, docuit post exitus ingens, seraque terrifici cecineri domina uates. Clint waits, eyes fixed on Phil, for a translation. So Phil gives it. The feathered arrow gave a dire portent, and latter augurs judge from this event. It's not a direct translation. Judge what? Phil takes a deep breath and tells him the rest all at once. Namque ulans liquidis in nubibus arsit arundo, signoi quiviam flammis tenuis cerecesset, consumta inuentos. Cae luceus sae perifixa, transcurunt crinemque ulantia sirera ducunt, atonitis haesere animis superos quirificati. Bless you, Clint replies, and they both chuckle a little. And then Clint abruptly drops his head into his hands again. Mutters and swallows hard, so that Phil can see the movement of his throat against the skin of his wrists, and guess at what he's saying. He translates quickly. Chafed by the speed, it fired, and as it flew, a trail of following flames ascending drew. Kindling they mount and mark the shiny way, across the skies as falling meteors play, and vanish into wind, or in a blaze decay. Clint repeats after him. It fired, and as it flew, a trail of flames. Following flames ascending drew. How do you know all this stuff? Clint asks, like he doesn't have dozens of poems at the ready in his head for the moment he needs them. Phil doesn't answer, because there's really only one reason he spends time memorizing archery-related poetry, and it's not something he's quite prepared to put into words yet. Instead, he says, You know the Etruscan god of archery is the same as their god of poetry? Really? Says Clint, and it comes out forced between his teeth. A substitute for something else he's trying not to need to say. Really? Phil says earnestly. And there's a Norse god of snowshoes. There's a quick grin that never makes it to Clint's eyes. More a programmed response than a real reaction. But he moves enough to pull the blankets off the couch between them, and wrap one around himself like armor against his thoughts. Phil's been trying to distract him from the whole situation. But maybe that's not the right approach. You should get some sleep, he says. and doesn't miss the flare of fear in Clint's eyes, before he tamps it down under a calm, steady archer's gaze. "Okay," is all Clint says. His voice is barely audible, but to his credit, it doesn't waver. "Okay." Phil waits for a moment, but Clint only hunches lower, pulls the blanket tighter around him, drops his gaze to the carpet between his feet. He's definitely not making any effort to sleep, and Phil suspects that if he went to bed right now, when he got up in the morning, Clint would still be here, staring into the space just in front of him, shoulders tense and hands twisted into the edges of the blanket. He gets up and heads for his bedroom, slipping through the half-open door and flipping the light switch as he enters. Once he's inside, he shucks his jacket and tie over the back of a chair, kneels by the bookcase, and pulls out an old, scarred, leather-bound book, cradling it carefully so that the loosest pages don't fall out. When he comes back to the living room, Clint is exactly the way Phil left him, exactly the way Phil knew he would be. He looks up when Phil settles back onto the couch. "You can tell me to leave," Phil says. Clint looks at him. "If you do, I'll go. But if you don't, I'm not going anywhere tonight." Clint looks at him, but doesn't say anything. Phil opens the book, brushing away the glue that flakes off over the word Virgil, faded on the cracking spine, and holds it out in Clint's direction. It's long moments before either of them moves, and when they do, Clint is the one who shifts closer to Phil and leans over the far edge of the pages. "Soon all of the figure bend their trusty bows, and from the quiver each his arrow shows," reads Clint. "Why don't they each have their own quiver?" "Don't question the great classics," Phil says wearily, but he's smiling. "I'm just saying," Clint argues, but he's almost smiling too, and Phil thinks, "This is better than it was." They aren't fixing anything tonight, not really. The inside of Clint's brain is complicated and there are no maps, and triggers like these are not a quick patch job. But they're here together with a book and a couple of blankets, and Phil's flawless Latin pronunciation like a shield against the night. And it's enough, at least, for now. They'll go from here. The end. Release and Follow Through. Part 5 of the Mindset series. Please note that this fic has trigger warnings for discussion of mental health issues. Clint is really good at saying really stupid things. It's not a skill set he likes to think about much. It gets into his head, distracts him, and he ends up in a kind of downward spiral where he remembers things further and further back and can't seem to stop. But it's there. It's a fact. He screws up a lot. He says things without thinking about them, or he thinks about them too much and has nothing adequate to say, so something wrong comes out instead. And when it happens, he can never shake it. It makes a space for itself in the middle of anything else he tries to think about. Sits waiting while he distracts himself, and comes right back to haunt him as soon as he thinks he may have managed to forget. He's trying to be better about it. About the stuff he says in the first place, and about what happens after. But it's slow going. And sometimes it isn't even something he can put into words. Sometimes he just walks away at the end of a conversation, and there's an uneasy feeling in the pit of his stomach, like something just wasn't right about it. Something he can't really get in his sights. And that's when he really should shut his brain off. Go to sleep or something. Start reciting, "You, darkness, that I come from." But he can't. Something just doesn't catch. And then the inexplicable uneasiness turns into something more unpleasant. And there's a deep, quiet burn of shame he can't understand. And he goes over and over the words he said and tries to figure out what was wrong with them. Sometimes he manages to dredge up the words of a poem, or, if he can't, then a song. And then he can set that against what goes on in his head, and it's a battle. It's exhausting. He's been trying it Phil's way. Relabel. Reattribute. Refocus. Revalue. But that doesn't work for this. He gets stuck on reattribute. Because he can't pass this off. Can't blame it on his stupid brain, or the thoughts he never means to have. Reattribute is not your fault. And that's not true when it was something he said that brought everything down around him. Or everything he said. Or even when he has no idea what it was that felt so off to him. Clint is too hyper-aware of things like that. Fumbling the Rubik's Cube into a muddled mess of colors that takes him hours to undo even though he's done it 1,000 times before. Because he can't concentrate when he's like this. Phil finds him sitting in the empty rec room. Rubik's Cube in his hands and forgotten. Its edges digging into his skin so that Phil can see the strain in his grip. Clint didn't want to be found. Not by Phil. Not when he hasn't had the time and distance yet to put whatever the hell he's done out of his memory. And tonight is one of those times when he isn't sure what it was. He's just unhappy about the whole thing. There's definitely something he should have said and didn't. Some wavelength he should have been on and wasn't. It's hard to hide, though. In a mansion full of people, with an AI that can track you anywhere you go, and a handler who knows the house inside out, and you even better. So Phil finds him, and he sits down next to him and says nothing. And Clint says nothing either. Safer that way. Better. He can't screw anything up if he just doesn't talk. Or at least, it will be a lot harder. They sit that way for a long time before Clint's fingers twitch on the Rubik's Cube, and he begins to turn it, lining up the white pieces along one edge, and trying to look like it's claiming all of his attention. Because Phil is going to try to talk to him, and he's already feeling drained and inadequate, and this will not end well. Phil doesn't try to talk to him, though. He just sits, and lets Clint ignore him, and fidget with the cube. And it's only when Clint begins to mutter the beginnings of poems he never finishes, that he says, "Clint." Calm and even, and with no aim at starting a conversation. Clint stops. Phil is right. If he starts this kind of thing, it's going to come back to bite him later on, when everything is unfinished, and there are too many loose threads to hunt them down and complete them all. And Phil always knows when Clint is letting himself go too far, always pulls him back. And Clint hates that as well, because one of these days is going to be too much for Phil. One of these days, Phil is going to decide that he can't be fixed. It's something Clint's been waiting for ever since he and Phil started to matter like this to one another. Ever since he realized, and never acknowledged aloud, that this was a kind of important he'd never had before. He might have been bracing for a blow ever since Phil gave him the Rubik's Cube, and started letting him sit in his office late at night, long before anything else, when it was hard enough to come to terms with the idea of friend, much less anything more. He's been waiting for a while now, and the other shoe has yet to drop. But it's not going to take much longer if he keeps making mistakes and saying stupid things, and getting it wrong and thinking too much or not enough. He's thinking about that, twisting the Rubik's Cube in both hands, until Phil reaches out and brushes his fingers over the back of Clint's hand. Not to stop him, but to remind him that he's still there. That he's not going anywhere. That whatever Clint is dealing with, they can do it together. Clint has to close his eyes, because no, he's the one who doesn't know how to police his words. He's the one who doesn't know how to tell which ones are right, and which ones make him curl in on the sharp sting of shame. And so he uses someone else's instead, because Shakespeare never made mistakes like Clint's. When he hears the words Clint is using as a defense against himself, there's just one half-swallowed word. Clint. Cut off at the end, because interrupting isn't a good thing for either of them. So instead Phil sits there, silent, while Clint goes through the sonnet twice and finishes, voice cracking. "For I am shamed by that which I bring forth. And so should you, to love things nothing worth." And that, right there, is the place where it lives. Guilt and shame and questioning, and everything that makes Clint go over the words of conversations afterward and wince at the things he said. Grimace at all the wrong ways they could have been read. Try to distract himself, and swallow down the ache of a mistake he's never really sure he's made, but regrets anyway. Phil shakes his head, and for a fraction of a second, fear spikes in Clint at the thought that, no, this is another mistake. But Phil just folds his hands around Clint's, Rubik's Cube and all. "I don't know what's wrong," he admits. "I don't know what's going on here, Clint, but whatever it is, come back. I'm right here." Phil gives him a look. Don't deflect. "What happened?" "I don't know." He doesn't. He really doesn't. All he knows is that he was talking to Phil, and it felt strange and strained and wrong. And then Phil left, and he did what he always does. Thought too much and too hard, and ended up here. And then Phil ended up here, too, with the rough skin of his hands against Clint's. Writer's mark, trigger calluses, ink stains, paper cuts. And a look on his face like he'll be here all night, if that's what it takes for Clint to figure out what's going on in his head. What he needs. And if Phil is here, then he can't have gotten everything completely wrong. Not as long as Phil is still willing to come after him. He shifts. Tucks his hands out from under Phil's, clicks the sides of the Rubik's Cube back and forth and into place, holds it up with not quite a smile when he's done. Some things are more easily solved than others. Phil gets it. He gets it, and he takes the Rubik's Cube from Clint's outstretched hand and holds it in the palm of his own, not breaking up the neat solution, not doing anything to it, just looking. "You know," says Phil, then stops. Clint watches him regroup his thoughts and thinks, that's how it's done. But he will never be like Phil, and that's not great, but it's okay. Phil seems okay with it, About that poem, he tries again. But before he can even start to make his case, Clint waves him off, immediate and dismissive and completely lacking in eye contact. It's just a poem, he says. Just a poem. Phil doesn't look like he believes it. Not that it's much of a bluff, really. But he makes his government inscrutable face and closes his fingers around the Rubik's Cube in his hand. Clint can see that there are things he wants to say, and he can guess at what those things might be. Not worthless, or maybe not ashamed, or something even harder to hear. It's better if Phil doesn't say them, because then Clint doesn't have to fight the battle between wanting to believe them for Phil's sake and needing not to for his own. In the end, Phil doesn't say any of them. What he does say is, "It's late, Clint," which in his particular brand of sparse language translates to, "You need sleep," and "Come to bed," and "This is the only way I know how to help," and "Eventually, I love you," whispered into the crook of his shoulder when Phil thinks he's asleep. "I love you. Not worthless. Not to me. Never." Clint knows he's supposed to be asleep, not listening to Phil murmur him reassurances, too private even to be shared between the two of them. All the same, he listens, and he curls closer into Phil's arms, and he tells himself that maybe this time he can work on trusting Phil, and letting go. The end. Hi, so this is Reganin. I decided as I was putting together the official album version of this that it might be kind of fun to put together a little reader's note for the end of it, just to talk a little bit about why I love this series and chose to record it. I can still remember the first time I ever read the series for the first time. It was back when I was just starting to get into the Avengers fandom in earnest, and I had one of those days where I stayed up until 4 a.m. reading fanfic, which is super healthy. And I was just starting to think of finally going to bed when I saw a rec for the series and thought, sure, why not? I'll read one more. And then the next time I looked up, it was 5 a.m. instead of 4, because I had read all 4 of the stories at the time, straight through, without stopping, because they're awesome and addictive. And I was, even though I was fairly sleep deprived at that point, I could tell that they were really well written. And, after I finally got some sleep and woke up the next day, I went and read all of Jay's other stories because he's a fantastic writer and writes amazing things. But the thing I like best about Mindset, in particular, all of this goes for Jay's writing in general, really, is that even though these were characters within an AU setting, all of their actions always felt really true to their characterization. I tend to have a really big weakness for Weldon AUs, and Jay's written tons of those, and they're all wonderful. But this has always been a common thread of his writing that I've enjoyed, that no matter what new situation he puts his characters in, their reactions always feel really natural and believable. I'm someone who's primarily interacted with fandom as a reader and a lurker, if you can count that as interaction exactly, and only recently gotten to podficking within the last few years. But in all of my experience in fandom, it's really valuable whenever you find an author who you can trust that every time you see a new story from them, they'll be doing justice to the characters. That you can know that going in, that this is going to be a good story. It's that high level of writing that drew me back to reread this series again and again. It's what led me to request permission to record Anchor and Hold in the first place. And it's what led me to keep going, and the snowball effect was really kind of astonishing after I got some very lovely people asking if I was thinking of continuing with the rest of the series after I posted the first part. And it's also because of this that if Jay chooses to write more stories in this verse, I'll probably be adding some more recordings at some point to this collection. So, stay tuned. And just on a closing note, thanks again to Jay for writing the series. Thank you for listening, and if you enjoyed this and are feeling in a commenty mood, please go let Jay or me know that you liked it.